Blog Talk Radio.
Clegstead, and I'll be hosting tonight's show along with Dr. Hope May. Would you like to say hi, Hope?
Hi.
And the rock star, Dr. Michael Rousseau.
Hello.
And we have an extra guest host tonight who may or may not tune in, but for now we'll leave it a mystery. Tonight's show is on justice, conceptions thereof, both modern and ancient. We sort of had a discussion with a caller, Joe, who some of you may be familiar with, on exactly what justice was. So we wanted to sort of tour the different conceptions throughout history and compare and contrast and note the void that seems to be in between. So on that note, I guess we'd like to start by just identifying what the modern conception of justice is. Do you remember what we really said on that show?
Are you talking to me?
I am, sorry.
I was kidding. Well, I do, sort of. But I want to say that when we're talking about the modern conception of justice, it's important to distinguish, on the one hand, the commonplace, what is called in philosophy, man-in-the-street conception of justice. So sort of like the lay person's conception of justice. And then there's the conception of justice that people with more legal expertise, if you will have. So I just first want to say, let's just address the man-in-the-street conception of justice. And Dr. Rousseau, do you want to say anything about what you take to be the man-in-the-street conception of justice?
Sure. I mean, basically, it's always a little bit dangerous to talk about the man in the street since that's not any one particular person, and you're obviously making, like, you know, generalizing, overarching sort of comment, but I think that for most people, overall, justice is related to equality in some sense, and specifically, like, connected with legal issues. That's my sense, anyway, that justice and equality enforced in some sort of a legal system
right. Is
what justice is about, anyway.
Okay, I just want to say, like, going back to your remark that it's dangerous to sort of hypothesize what the man in the street may say, I just want to say that built in to the legal system is this conception of the, quote, reasonable and prudent person. And it's been defined one way by, quote, the man who rolls up his sleeves and mows the lawn at night and takes in magazines.
And
okay,
what
like
was the last part?
Action. Like takes in magazines or reads magazines. So you've got like a lawn mowing magazine reading person. And I just want to say that in the law that there is this conception of quote unquote man in the street. It's not called that, it's called reasonable person. But when you actually get to the actual definitions of what the reasonable and prudent person is, at least in one case, it's stated to be a person who mows the lawn and reads magazines.
All right.
So in any case, so you're saying that the average person takes the concept of justice to be connected with equality and with this judicial machinery that we see in society, like courts of law and stuff like that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense.
Okay. And Mike, do you want to add anything to that?
I think day-to-day law enforcement plays a huge role there. I mean, justice instantly thinks state trooper. For me, rather than the man on the street, I'm just Joe Collar. That's my man on the street. And I think his preference of justice was eye for an eye.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is done unto you, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So retribution definitely is there for the everyday man on the street.
Okay. So we've got this idea of justice as, or this common conception of justice as it involves the legal system, it involves retribution. And I want to, you know, and this goes back to what we were talking about before in prior shows, I think it was 2 weeks ago. So when we get into the more legalistic conception of justice, little bit more sophisticated, if you will, but not much by any means. There is a distinction made amongst what we call procedural justice. Due process would fall under that. Distributive justice, and Mike, what you were just talking about, retributive justice, an eye for an eye, is an approach to wrongdoing that's been done to you. So I know, Mike, you've had some law classes, and you can talk about procedural justice. Do you want to say anything about what that means?
Sure. As you called it, the machinery, just sort of the process that one goes through, whether it be a civil suit or a criminal suit in which one is the accused, the defendant. I don't know really what to say as far as relevance, but I think the ordinary person thinks of that as a system of equality. Like, that is how I achieve my equality, by having my quote-unquote day in court.
Mm.
I guess that is our protection from the legal system, if that makes sense.
Right, or an arbitrary use of power by the state.
Right.
So, like, the whole idea of a jury of one's peers.
Exactly.
And that the state has to have some sort of probable cause for stopping you. These sorts of things are what we mean by procedural justice. So here we're talking about, like, restraints put on the state so that they don't arbitrarily abuse their power.
Right.
Cool. Dr. Russo, do you want to say anything about procedural justice?
No, not in particular.
Okay. We talked about distributive justice a couple weeks ago. Mike, do you want to say anything about that?
I'm not sure. I don't even recall the discussion 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And that note. Can
okay.
you refresh my memory and see what it gets
me? I can try.
Okay.
Distributive justice is when we're talking about the distribution of benefits and burdens.
Right.
And so there are different approaches as to how you distribute benefits and burdens. Do you distribute benefits and burdens, for example, according to need, or do you distribute it according to merit, or do you distribute it according to labor? Amartya Sen, who we've been talking about in his book, The Idea of Justice, uses this example of a flute, and there are three people making a claim for this flute. One person has no toys whatsoever. Another person has made the flute, and the other person legally owns the flute, but it was stolen from herself. And so then the question is, okay, to whom does the flute rightfully belong? So this is a question of distributive justice. So here we're talking about the distribution of benefits and burdens amongst society and on what principle we make that distribution. So like I said, this isn't so much a man in the street type of conception. We're getting a little bit more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, like this last prong of justice under this more legal, sophisticated conception is retributive. Do you want to say anything about that, Mike?
Right. Punishment, I guess, is the best thing I could say.
Right.
Commit a crime and receive in kind.
Mm-hmm.
Distributive justice, I just wanted to note, in regards to man on the street, I think that has more to do with like societal mores, I guess you'd almost say. I mean, as a capitalist society, we have very minimal expectations about justice in that regard. Things like, I don't even know if this is, I guess welfare is the direction I've had, that's sort of our minimal expectation of what we should have, whereas in other states, you know, you might point to a communist state, there's a much more equalized expectation.
Right, and we don't even have to go to communism, and if we go to Europe, for instance, education, so long as you do well in high school, depends what you do in high school, at least I'm thinking of Belgium, for instance. But if you perform well in high school, then you have access to university. And depending how well you perform depends, you know, will determine to which universities you have access to. Whereas if you don't perform that well in high school, you will go to, like, a trade school. Like, you will learn to be a hotel manager or something like this, hospitality school. Very, very common in Europe, actually, and there's a big hospitality school in The Hague in the Netherlands. But, sure, so there's this question, and I think in our country now we're talking about, like, the idea of healthcare.
Right.
That that, like, it's a minimal, and I know that Amartya Sen has this view, and I'm not saying it's correct or incorrect, I'm just saying, like, here is a notion of distributive justice that, like, a minimal condition of a just society is to furnish health care for its citizens. So, yeah, that's a question of distributive justice.
Basically, that people don't die from lack of food, shelter, medical care. I think that's the Peter Singer mantra.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
As far as retributive justice, I think in our society the expectation is if you commit a crime, you'll pay in jail time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might not be so true today with overcrowded prisons and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really it, though. I mean, other than the death penalty, right? We have jail time, community service, perhaps.
Well, one could think that, you're talking about criminal law, with tort law, you could pay a fine.
Right.
So paying a fine or going to jail. In other countries, other forms, like other ways that retribution is imposed on the wrongdoer, like perhaps you may lose a certain civil right, like you may lose your right to vote or your right to participate in some sort of community ceremony, but you lose something, whether it's money, liberty in the sense of being able to walk around, because you could lose liberty by being in a jail cell, or you could, you know, have your liberty somewhat severed away by losing a civil right like the right to vote, but you could not necessarily be in jail.
Right.
So there's different ways of going at addressing the harm done by a wrongdoer. And I think it's important to note, and it's something that we try to bring out in the first show that we did about justice, that when we're talking about justice, we're not just, and even in the modern conception, we're not just talking about the response to wrongdoing. And I think that's something that we kind of got hung up on a couple of weeks ago, this whole idea of eye for an eye, that if that's your sole conception of justice, you're really hung up on the conception of justice as wrongdoing. But as we're seeing, like, distributive justice, for the most part, doesn't really seem to be concordant with the notion of wrongdoing. It's more like the distribution of goods and burdens. Dr. Russo, do you want to add anything to this? Because you've been kind of quiet.
Not in particular. I mean, I think that, insofar as, as it's been described here, I think, whatever, more or less, this more refined conception of justice is, in a way, nicely, makes more explicit what I think is basically, implicit in the average person's sense that justice
mm-hmm.
should encompass these kind of things. And so, cool.
Right. So really what you're saying is that this legal, more sophisticated view of justice is really the man in the street's conception of justice if such a person would sit down with Socrates for a while. They would realize that this is their true conception.
Something like
I'm
that.
I'm trying
sure.
to be funny, yet again, and
okay.
stamping this for me.
Okay.
But, yeah, you're saying, this is implicit in, it rings true. How's that?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So at this point, I guess we should transition to, because we've been talking about, the modern conception, and we can talk about modern theories of justice. But we're not going to do that. We just wanted to sort of lay out, the shell at the very, this minimal conception of a modern approach to justice, and it at least is going to involve procedural, distributive, and retributive aspects. But this show, as Mike said in the beginning, is about ancient versus modern conceptions. And to make that transition, I want to play a short clip from the film Judgment at Nuremberg. We've talked about this film before on our show. This is not a documentary. It's like a feature film with Spencer Tracy and Maximilian Schell. It's an excellent film, a dramatization of the Nuremberg trials, which were the trials of Nazis after World War II. And it was the Nuremberg trials which really, I wouldn't say that, what I'm about to say, but they had a lot to do with the formation of the International Criminal Court and international law, which we've talked about before. But in this clip, who's talking is the actor Maximilian Schell. His character is Herr Rolf, and he is actually the defense attorney for the judges in the dock. So in the film Judgment at Nuremberg, it is about the actual judgment of the judges who are enforcing the laws of the Third Reich. And eventually the judicial system in the Third Reich just became, lost its way, obviously. And so in this clip you have Herr Rolf, who's the defense attorney for the Nazi judges, and he's just making an abstract statement about what the court and the tribunal is about. And this is just like the first 2 minutes of his opening statement. I will tell you that it will begin in German, but it will be translated. And here it comes. It's about 2 minutes long.
Der anerkannte Sinn dieses Gerichts,
the avowed purpose of this tribunal,
is broader than the visiting of retribution on a few men. It is dedicated to the reconsecration of the Temple of Justice. It is dedicated to finding a code of justice the whole world will be responsible to. How will this code be established? It will be established in a clear, honest evaluation of the responsibility for the crimes in the indictment stated by the prosecution. In the words of the great American jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes, this responsibility will not be found only in documents that no one contests or denies. It will be found in considerations of a political or social nature. It will be found, most of all, in the character of men.
Right, so that is the end of the clip, and it's really that very last line where he talks about the importance of the character of men as being crucial to the just proceedings or elaboration of this universal code that is about to be developed in this tribunal. And so, Dr. Russo, I'll start with you. Any reactions to that clip? What do you think?
Well, I think that's a profound clip, as it were. And I think his insight that the justice must be rooted in the character of human beings and not in some abstract set of rules and codes is... you know, harkens back to what ancient philosophers were keen on pointing out. In some of our earlier shows, like not the previous one, but before that, if I'm remembering correctly, mm-hmm. you know, we kind of like touched on and got close to, but didn't really go the full nine yards on this topic, that in the ancient viewpoint, justice is really a characteristic of the individual person's soul. Like that is where it exists and is rooted. And I think that that is not just an arbitrary sort of thing. There's a reason that their viewpoint was that way, and that is because basically they were very sensitive to the fact that there are very many elements that are complex and somewhat intractable about differing situations that make it somewhat impossible to formulate any kind of an algorithm or abstract set of rules that will always identify, you know, what the just action is or what the just punishment is or what the just thing to do is in any way in every situation. Aristotle is fond of pointing out many times that, you know, we act in a world of particulars, when we make a choice and do something, it's always in relationship to like some specific situation in which we are acting. And it's necessary to always be sensitive to, you know, those particularities in order to find out and discern like what the just thing to do is. And that's something that can't be just extracted and extrapolated and set in stone, you know, for eternity in some abstract realm. And so it's necessary for a person within himself or herself to have this characteristic that enables him or her to, like, be able to determine what is called for in this situation, here and now. So justice must be something that is inherent in a person and not in a set of rules. That's what I get from it.
Cool. Mike, do you want to say anything?
I'd just like to point out, this should be completely obvious to most of our listeners at this time, that this sort of view that Dr. Rousseau is presenting is in stark contrast with the modern conception of justice, which is this abstract, you know, procedural machinery that one goes through in case of, like when something happens, justice kicks in. And in a case, not so, with the ancient philosophers, it's sort of like a central to a person's being. And I'm definitely not an expert, so I'm not going to rant on about what Aristotle says about justice, but just point that out.
Cool. Yeah, so Dr. Rousseau, anything else?
Well, since you asked, because we have mentioned numerous times in recent shows different perspectives introduced from like Taoist teachings, I think also that insight that there cannot be some one set of rules to follow that will always yield, you know, the proper action is an insight that is central to Taoist thinking. There's a very famous opening line of Lao Tzu's poem, the Tao Te Ching, which is often translated as the way that can be named is not the eternal way. And you know, other methods of translating that statement basically make it out to suggest that you know, the way, the proper mode of being in a situation is not a thing that can be stated in a rule abstractly. You know, at the time, in whatever Chinese culture, there was a sort of opposing view that tried to express the notion that there should be a codified sort of set of rules, like for this action, this punishment should be administered. You know, for this action, this reward should be administered, so that everything could just be mechanically set up so there would be no indecision or lack of clarity and made mechanical, basically. And partly what Lao Tzu is saying in that opening line is, like, that can't be done. And I like to think of it like the Tao is kind of like, you know, with a capital T, is like the method that always works. Sometimes it'll be one way of proceeding, and at other times it'll be another way of proceeding, and it depends on the situation. And that doesn't mean it's all just totally indeterminate and, like, guesswork. Then, you know, there obviously are, like, guidelines that are generally sound, but it still is always necessary for the agent who acts to be present to the, like, here and now situation, and to bring to it that kind of insight that can enable him or her to, like, know which way to go, how to deal with it.
Right. And going back to Mike's point about how this idea of justice is totally, contrary to the modern conception of this idea of, like, rules that, or some machinery that kicks in case, as you put it, I want to say that, you know, and I think what I hear you saying, Dr. Rousseau, is surely, like, some of the times it's clear what the just response is, but to think that all of the time we can consult this set of rules just sort of blindly, if you will, is wrong, and that justice involves some sort of modification or extension or broadening of the rules that are established. And I just want to say that in the legal tradition, and this comes from a passage in Aristotle in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics, where he makes a distinction between justice and equity. And he says, justice is defective owing to its universality. And what he means by that, I think, is that, as you're saying, Dr. Russo, that when we're operating in the world, we're always dealing with, like, specific situations, specific particulars, that sort of thing. But in order for a law to have any purchase, if you will, on the specifics or particulars, it must be stated in general terms. It has to be able to apply to a number of situations. So it has to be stated in general terms. But that necessary fact or feature of the law is actually what makes it defective, because it then loses sight of what really matters in justice, which is the particular. And so what Aristotle says is, equity is actually this corrective of justice, which is defective owing to its universality because it's expressed in language, whereas the particular is really, if you correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Russo, it's really the object of perception or discernment. Would you agree with that much?
I would agree.
Okay. So you have, like, this object of perception, and then you have a rule, which is perhaps an object of reason, if you will. And what Aristotle says is that this perception is actually higher than justice, and equity corrects it. And it's through discerning correctly that, in this case, we shouldn't mechanically apply the rule because it will actually work an injustice. That is really what it is to be fully just, if you will. Does that make sense?
It does.
Shall I give
think,
an example?
You know, sure.
Would that help?
Yes.
I think it will help. And I what scares me, and it goes back to Mike's point, not Dr. Russo, but Mike Klagstad's point about how this is so different from the modern conception of justice. And I think that we hear in our society an expression of this modern conception of justice when we hear people saying, quote, it's our policy. You guys know what I'm talking about? It's our policy to do this. Okay, yeah. So this is a true story. My husband was operated on at the Mayo Clinic, and he was not in a very good state, and it was just me with him, and it was difficult for me to, you know, manage him, if you will. And I was able to get him down from his hospital room to the front of the hospital. This is St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota. And it was no small feat to do this. And I needed to get him to the hotel. He was discharged from his hospital room, and I needed to get him to the hotel. And he could really, you know, barely stand on his own. He was on a walker, and it was a struggle to keep him actually upright on the walker itself. So I finally get him to the front of the hospital, and on my cell phone I call a cab company. And I said, can you please pick us up? We're in the front of St. Mary's, and we need to go to blah, blah, blah hotel. And the woman on the other end said, oh, I'm sorry, but it's our policy that if somebody calls from St. Mary's, you have to go in and have the concierge call for the cab. And I said, why? And she said, because lots of people call us from St. Mary's, and they're, like, up in their room, and our cab drivers are waiting down in the front for, you know, a half hour, and we just don't want that to happen. And I said, well, I'm standing right in the front right now, and I see cab number Y23XZ pulling up, and I see Ralph, his name tag, with a red plaid shirt getting out. And so I was giving her, you know, concrete evidence that I was in the front of the building. And she was responding, "I'm sorry, it's our policy." See, and I think in this case, this is what Aristotle's talking about, that here we need, you know, an act of discernment and, you know, the insight of someone saying, oh, okay, in this case, yeah, the policy is wrong to apply because the very reasons for it in the first place are not met because I have substantive. I can, like, call Ralph. You know, I could be like, "Ralph, are you in the front? Are you wearing a plaid shirt? Yep. Do you see this woman, like, waving to you? Yep." She could have done that, but no, she just refused. And then another cab pulled up, and I had to, like, tell my husband, I was like, "Just stay here. I've got to walk back in there." And I literally had to call the concierge. And one thing that scares me is just this blind reliance on policy and this refusal to recognize the unique situation of people is perhaps falling outside of the scope of the policy. Sorry, this is, you know, one of my... This whole response, the matter of policy is something that bothers me greatly in the modern world.
Yes, me too. It's horrific, actually.
As long as we're on this note, I think on this note, some might say very broadly and generally that this sort of lack of discernment is what led to things like the Holocaust
mm-hmm.
or other acts of tyranny by government officials.
I brought that up to the woman on the... She didn't take too kindly to it. I said, you know, it's really like what you're doing now is what made Nazi Germany possible. Click. But anyway, yeah. No, please elaborate on that point.
Well, I guess all I was going to say is that, you know, when you let the machinery sort of take a ride and do what it will, it gives individuals a vehicle with which to be arbitrary and capricious because whoever's in control of the machinery, obviously, it trickles down. You know, it's in control of everything else. There's no point at which anyone can sort of put the brakes on, as you're saying this lady could have done in your situation.
Mm.
She could have simply said, yeah, the policy says this, but screw it. It doesn't really apply here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know any other direction to go with that without being, you know, too...
Well, I can go in a more global direction, and I'm using that word in, you know, ironic sense, I guess. But what's happening a lot with United States companies is their call centers are being outsourced to India. And these people in India are given an American name. They say, like, "Hi, you're speaking to Susie,"
mm-hmm.
okay? And they're, I know because I've dealt with such people,
mm-hmm.
And they're reading a script. And it's even more maddening because, like, they have no concept. Like, they want their job. They want to be loyal to their employer. And they're told, you read this script, and this is what you do. And I remember being on the phone with one such person. I won't name the company. But at one point I said, look, I'm a human being. You're a human being, you know, that kind of thing. But my point being is that it's not only a problem, like, in our country, if you will, but insofar as our industries are being exported and the workers are being told, this is exactly what you say, and there's not any sort of training for, okay, here's a special kind of case, and if this factor, then do this. I mean, no, it's clear that she was just reading this blanket policy. Dr. Russo, any response?
You know, I would throw in that, a couple things. One being in the opening sections of the Metaphysics by Aristotle, he talks about the superior knowledge of the master craftsman who understands, like, why and how things really work by having had experience with doing and working on things, as opposed to the people who simply, like, follow the instructions that the master craftsman, you know, provides from his experience. And so their knowledge is inferior, and they can't really sort of, he doesn't put it in these terms, but, like, improvise when something that doesn't fit into the general plan, you know, arises. And, yes, this blanket blind following of policy, you know, that's our policy, has also caused much stress on my part. I would also throw in that the things we're saying about justice being like in relation to a specific situation, you know, ultimately, finally, when it comes to acting, is true also in the perspective, especially of Aristotle, about the other virtues of the soul as well, you know, overall, that the actions that we take are always within particular circumstances. Things like courage, you know, just as an example to help whatever, fill out the notion about how it's always in relation to some specific situation. You know, we think of, like, let's say, or especially in Aristotle's time, the sort of, like, ideal example of courage would be, like, fighting on the battlefield and facing possible death, you know, when that was the noble thing to do. That would be the prime example of courage, facing death on the battlefield. I think as an example, you know, we could think of, like, in the Iliad, Achilles, who's, like, the skilled and trained and, you know, whatever, embodiment of, like, excellence for a warrior, fights in battle, he's exhibiting courage, but when his, let's see, I forget his exact relation, I think it was his nephew, Patroclus, he rushes, I don't think so, anyway, that's neither... Maybe. It's neither here nor there in this context. When Patroclus runs into battle, it's rash and unwise. He's not as skilled, and so he does the same thing in one sense. It's like the same act. He even, like, tries to impersonate, you know, Achilles. it's the same act, but it does not display the same virtue. So in a way, it's like he's doing the same thing, but in a way... In a deeper sense, it's like exemplifying something different. It's like he's not really prepared for what he's rushing into. And so it always finally, like, has to link back to the person who is acting. That's where the virtue, whether it's justice or courage or whatever else, is always, has to be alive, as it were.
And so, Patroclus in this case is sort of like, just, I think the analogy, it's not really an analogy, but the point that you're making is Patroclus insofar as he's, like, mimicking the actions of the master warrior, which is Achilles in this case, like, he's just mimicking. He doesn't have the understanding. He's not, like, the master warrior. And so, like, it's not right. He's just blindly following, quote unquote, the actions of what what he sees to be the master warrior doing, and he lacks a deeper understanding of when to deploy, you know, the moves or whatever they are.
And I mean, just to whatever add it in, but you know, Achilles acts courageously, but Patroclus does not. It's not courage. It's like rash. You know, it's lack of action. So it doesn't exemplify a virtue. Even though in a way he's like
say that Achilles acts like a big baby, you know. But anyway,
he does. That's true. That's a different. That's a different element that he may have taken his rage a little too far and pouted. And but anyway, I think
that's
the example is good. Yes, it's good enough to make the point that in one sense they seem to be doing the same thing, like running into battle and fighting, but. Because those actions originate from a different kind of a character and a different set of, like, skills to deal with the situation properly, it's like it's not the same thing that they're doing in a deep way.
Mike, do you want to say anything?
Not on that point.
Okay. I also wanted to say that, you know, we've been talking about Aristotle and this idea of, like, the importance of discernment and the perception of the particular and, like, the importance of recognizing, okay, in this particular case, I don't apply the rule because doing so would actually be unjust. But in a couple of shows, it was two shows ago, I believe, when we first started talking about justice, in this sense, we had a caller, James, who asked about Plato's view of justice. And Plato does not talk about, like, this discernment and perception to the extent that Aristotle does, but he does have a substantive definition of justice. And Dr. Russo, I believe that James asked you to discuss it, and I'm asking you the same thing, so we can sort of see how this relates to Aristotle's view.
Okay.
Just jump into that.
Okay? Basically, you know, in a word, in a short nutshell, Plato's definition of justice within the soul of an individual human being is that justice is present in the soul when the parts of the soul are in harmony with one another, or when, as Socrates says in the Republic, when each part of the soul minds its own business and stays within its own appropriate sphere or within its appropriate, like, borderlines, actually. I think it's interesting, actually, to just throw in here that in ancient Greek, you know, literature and poetry and so on, the notion of justice and borderlines are very much, like, connected, crossing over the borderline of your own specific, like, lot or zone. And in ancient Greek mythology, Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades were all three brothers who each had their own appropriate, like, sphere within the universe, so that Zeus was, like, the ruler of the sky, and Poseidon of the sea, and Hades of the underworld. And whenever one or the other of these gods would, like, overstep his bounds and go into the other one's zone, this was, like, injustice. There's a similar sort of here in Plato's view about justice in the soul. Whenever your the three parts of the soul in Plato's view here are that you have reason or the rational part of the soul, faculty that enables you to have insight. On the one hand, you have what in Greek is called thumos, which is basically like your the tricky part of the soul, and Plato, like, waffled around somewhat on what he exactly means, but basically your sense of your self-image, basically, and your pride in it and sense that you should defend it. And when you feel that you have been wronged, you become, like, righteous indignation sort of thing. You become angry about it. All those things are, like, wrapped up in the spirited part of the soul, is how people usually refer to it. And on the other hand, there is the appetitive or appetite-based part of the soul, which is related to, like, desire for indulgence and sense pleasure and so on. And so, Plato is saying when each part of the soul, like, occupies its own proper place, as it were, and has its own proper role in the inner workings of your psyche, and falls into its own role that it's suited for by nature, then you have justice. All the parts of the soul are harmonious, or they all fit together to produce, like, one total person. So that when you act, it is like yourself as a total being that is committed and understands, you know, what you're doing and so forth. There are a number of passages in Plato where he sort of makes a connection between a person whose elements in their soul are at odds with one another, and we all kind of know this experience of, like, having a notion within your thought or understanding that, like, a certain course of action is not wise to do, and yet sort of having a sort of itching, gnawing desire to do it anyway, and there's, like, an internal struggle about how you should behave and so on. When all of these elements, as Aristotle says, actually speak with the same voice, and all are unanimous about a decision, this is what Plato is referring to as justice, when things are harmonious or each thing plays its own proper role in the soul.
Cool. And I just wanted to say, even though our modern conception of justice seems to be far removed from this, like, internal discernment, these internal capacities have their own boundaries and borders. Ironically, we do see in law, and especially in corporate law, this notion of proper boundaries. And actually, when a certain aspect of a corporation oversteps its bounds, this is called ultra vires. It's like beyond its scope of power. So I just wanted to say, and when I took business law many years ago, it struck me that the restrictions that we place on corporations and the expectations that we have of corporations and the duties of corporate officers to corporations are much more sacred than the duties that the law imposes upon people to each other. So, for example, this concept of fiduciary duty, duty of care, and so forth, which is like a very big notion in business law. Like if you actually are disloyal to the corporation and you're acting out of your own self-interest and you're making deals that jeopardize the welfare of the corporation, blah, 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 that's a crime. Whereas not so much in our realm of personal relations. We can act in our own self-interest, and we don't have such high duties of care to each other, and we have the moral freedom to, you know, to put it bluntly, screw each other over and so forth. And so I just want to say that I think it's interesting that we do see this concept of borders and overstepping one's borders as a wrong in law, but mostly in business law. But my question is, cool, so how does this idea of justice has something to do with respecting the borders of one's internal capacities? How does that relate to this theme of discernment and perception that we've been talking about?
Well, basically I would say that let me back up just for a second and say a couple things. One, I think to get a feel for what Plato is talking about, you could imagine anything that involves like multiple components that have to function together. If you think of like a football team, I like to use this example. If every guy on the team is like, I want to score the touchdown, and they all fight each other for the ball, you know, this team is not going to do too well. They're not really like a unified force that's going to move like along the football field, as it were. They're not going to win too many games. Whereas if each like person on the team adopts the role that's assigned and that he fits in the whole team overall, then the team is like unified as one thing, in addition to, I don't know, however many players are on a football field at a time. But anyway, there's something else there. There's like the whole team is one thing, basically. And so Plato uses this kind of an analogy with like a city-state where everyone disagrees and it's in factions. They can't really accomplish anything as like a unified whole. And so similarly, a human being who is in factions within himself or herself, all fragmented with like different impulses going in different directions, can't really make a unified action. And so the wisdom that is possible for the rational part of the soul to wield, if you will, the insights that the rational part of the soul has a capacity for yielding are snuffed out, as it were, if the desiring part of the soul, let's say, is too predominant. It steps into place where the rational part should be governing, kind of thing. So to have your parts of your soul like cooperate with one another and give each other their own sort of like zone is the thing that enables the rational part to awaken itself and give you an insight about, you know, what is just and what is best. And let me just throw in lastly that also it is on the behalf of like the whole soul or the whole person that the rational soul's insights are presented, as it were. It's easy to get the impression that, you know, when ancient philosophers talk about this kind of thing about, you know, reason should rule and desire should, like, follow it kind of thing, that there's this kind of, like, repression and, you know, indulgence in any kind of pleasure is, like, bad and should be crushed and we should all just, like, think methodically and logically about everything. And that's not exactly really what they're talking about, I think, at all. That the insight and the intelligence that is possible for a human being can, like, seep into the desire, as it were, so that the things that you actually want and the things that you understand to be good for you and best are the same thing. And so that's, like, a powerful, source of action in a human being when your desires and your understanding are all unified. And that's what Plato is talking about when it comes to justice.
Yeah, I just want to say you've been listening to ethics talk and we're talking about justice. And no one has called in tonight. I'm surprised. We have 10 minutes remaining in the show, and you are free to call in. 646-727-3928 is the number. And I want to pose this question to anybody who's willing to answer it. What it occurred to me is you were talking about Plato's view of justice, Dr. Russo. And going back to what we were saying before about, like, the blind adherence to policy being bad, and it came to me when you were talking about this analogy of the football players, and everybody has their specific role. Couldn't it be the case that, okay, I don't know anything about football, whatever, I don't know what a linebacker does, but so let's suppose, like, the linebacker, you know, has a specific role, but there is this specific circumstance where he realizes maybe that if he goes outside of his role, he can, like, I don't know, score, help the team win or something like this. I'm just going to let you think about that, and we have a caller. I don't know if they just want to listen in or if they have a question, so I'm just going to take the call since we have 9 minutes left.
Hello.
Hi, caller, you're on Ethics Talk.
How you doing? First of all, I just want to say, like, I'm kind of like a layman. You know, I haven't read any Plato or Aristotle or anything like that, so, you know, I don't know if you want to entertain me, you know, given that, but I'm just wondering, like, because I've thought about this myself before, as far as the question that you have in your little, you know, your description there. Why be moral? You know, but the way I think about it is why not be moral? You know, I mean, if I don't know what position or what perspective Plato and Aristotle had on it, but, you know, I personally look at life as having, like, no meaning or purpose, ultimately, you know what I mean? But, you know, if that's the case, then you could say why be moral, but you don't have any more or less of a reason to not be moral, you know what I mean?
Dr. Russo, do you want to take that one?
You know, I think that's a good observation. It would seem like, you know, all else being equal, yes, I mean, that's a good point. Why not be moral? There are, you know, various things that people might say, just like in Plato's Republic, when Adeimantus and Glaucon are, like, questioning Socrates, they point out, you know, we agree with you, Socrates, about justice being worthwhile for its own sake, but we want to, like, genuinely, truly understand that and know that, and so we're going to be like the devil's advocates and kind of try to force you to really prove it, kind of thing. I mean, someone could say, you know, why not be just? Well, because, you know, you could, like, reap a lot of benefits, it would seem, by just taking whatever taking more for yourself and getting whatever would please you, kind of thing. And Socrates is sort of dedicated to explaining why, if you were to pursue such a course of action, in the end, you know, it's not really to your benefit, actually.
Right, and I think also, unfortunately, the caller is gone. Caller, if you want to call back, please do so. But I also want to say that I think one thing that, like, is different from the Greek conception of morality and justice and the conception that's premised in the caller's question, because the caller said, like, life has no meaning, and therefore, since it has no meaning, like, it's arbitrary whether you're moral or immoral. That's how I understood the question. So one could ask the question, why not be moral? There is no meaning. But for the Plato and Aristotle, at least, you know, the soul, they're really thinking of a human being as an organism that has, like, a specific natural, the word is telos, or end, towards which the creature is developing. And that is really the locus of meaning and purpose, if you will. It's sort of like built into our DNA. It's the kind of animals that we are. I've used the phrase before, purpose-driven animals, that we're the kind of creature that seeks purpose and meaning, and we must make meaning. And I think that Plato and Aristotle see that as just part of what it is to be a human being. and that perhaps justice and morality have something to do with that. But our caller is no longer there, so I would like to go back with our remaining 5 minutes to my linebacker question. And, Mike, you're laughing at it. Do you have anything to say?
I can give you a better scenario.
Okay, please do.
Let's say that we're the Detroit Lions. We didn't convert on the third down, which means we're bringing in the punt squad, okay? So it's not Hansen, but let's pretend it's Jason Hansen who's going to punt the ball. And his snap is flubbed. It goes flying in the air. What does he do? Can't punt the ball. Defense is going to be on him in about 10 seconds. I think this is sort of where you were going with this. It's an opportunity for him to act outside his normal duties
mm-hmm.
and potentially succeed in a very big way.
Mm-hmm.
He can grab the ball and throw it. And this has actually happened in the Detroit Lions game, and it was a touchdown.
Hmm.
So, I mean, this is perfectly possible for the kicker in this circumstance to pick up the ball and toss it to some guy who looks like he can catch.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know where you were going with that, but I think it's at least a more realistic scenario.
Well, where I was going with it is, like, going back to Dr. Russo's claim about justice is this, like, sort of when the soul is unified. There's this whole idea of reason ruling. And it may be that, like, for reason to really rule, and this goes back to equity also, for reason to really rule, it knows when it should perhaps take a back seat to some sort of, I don't know, gut or what you want to, thumos, whatever. Dr. Russo, with 3 minutes left.
No, I mean, I know your point. I agree, and that's true. That, you know, especially it's evident in, like, the football team example, you know, good point, cool. sometimes it might be necessary to improvise and adapt, but my point, though, is that they all have, like, one common objective that they function for, and it's not like every man for himself trying to score the touchdown. That, I think, is what Plato has in mind when, you know, initially, like, the uneducated person is one in whom each part of the soul is, like, trying to score the touchdown. Like, every part of the soul has its own drive and wants to be in the driver's seat, and it's kind of like a struggle within the self. So when there's this, like, unanimous agreement about, you know, what is good and so forth, that kind of unity of soul is what is justice in Plato's definition. Anyway.
Our caller is actually back. So, caller, we've got 2 minutes left, so go for it.
I just wanted to speak to what you were saying earlier about how, I think you said it was Plato, that the, you know, human beings are kind of just this being, you know, this group of organisms that is heading towards some ultimate end. Like, I think I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like analog. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, like you know how
as opposed to digital.
What?
As opposed to digital.
Well, I mean, okay. I'm sorry, but like you know how morphogenesis works when an embryo is forming. You know, the cells kind of, you know, form a shape. Almost, you know, unconsciously, but they know, you know, each individual cell knows where to go. I think that's the way human beings, like, that's the way it works with human beings. Like, we're, you know, we're more complex than these single-celled organisms, but, you know, we're ultimately just, you know, we're basically subject to, you know, our brain cells interact with each other, basically. Yeah, sorry, I guess I'm kind of nervous or something, but our brain cells interact with each other, you know, governed by specific rules, you know, specific laws of the universe, fundamental laws of the universe. And I don't know where I'm really going with this at this point, but...
Well, that's how it starts. That's how we all start, just talking. And it's... We have 60 seconds left. Does anybody want to? And what's your name, caller?
My name's Kyle.
Kyle.
K-Y-L-E.
Thanks for calling, Kyle. We have like 49 seconds left. I don't know if we can do justice to your comment. Mike, you want to go ahead?
Well, in an effort to sort of sum up what's going on here, I don't know that I can respond to Kyle specifically. We're talking about these two different conceptions of justice, the modern one, which is that justice is this procedural in the case of entity, in the ancient conception, via Aristotle and Plato, which is justice is a part of us. Somehow it's something intrinsically motivating us and pushing us that we have to act in accordance with. I don't know that we can go over all the vice versa comparison, contrast, again. But I guess what we'd really say if we had to sum it up is it's not like these ancients didn't have a law system. It's not as though they didn't have, you know, a procedural system. The idea is it's not so abstract. It's not so far away. It's on top of something within us. Is there any way we can restate that? Anybody?
Well, the show is no longer streaming, so we're off the air, but we're still be on the iTunes podcast. But, no, I think that's good. And, Kyle, please call back because this whole idea, you're bringing in, like, neuroscience and brain chemistry, and I think that's very, very important. And, you know, just to connect to what we're saying is, like, and what Mike is saying and what Plato and Aristotle are saying, that all of those things are related, and the goal is to have, you know, the brain chemistry, if you will, operating in a way in which, to go back to Dr. Russo's point, the organism is unified. Dr. Russo, sound right?
Yes.
Okay, well, we're off the air, so you have been listening to Ethics Talk. Thank you, Mike, silent mystery guest who didn't say anything, Dr. Russo, and Kyle. Kyle, call back again. Comments are awesome, and thank you for listening to Ethics Talk.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.